You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. This week we discuss two great comedians. Later on, we'll talk with Kitty Bruce about her father, the iconoclastic comedian Lenny Bruce. But first, we talk with novelist John Connolly about Stan Laurel of the great movie comedy team Laurel and Hardy. John Connolly is a novelist best known for his series of thrillers featuring his detective character Charlie Parker. His new book is a departure from that, entitled He. He is a novel based on the life of the great comic Stan Laurel. John Connolly, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I love the novel, He. And it must have been very different for you as a writer. I mean, since, you know, no one gets their face cut off or anything in the book.
No, there's violence in it, but not that kind of violence. Yeah, it dates, curiously, right back to the beginning of my career. I was staying with a friend in Los Angeles, in Malibu, who had met Stan Laurel. And I just simply couldn't conceive somebody I know having met him, because probably like a certain generation of Americans, I grew up with them on television. You know, I watched them when I was on vacation or if there was a gap in the schedule. But they seemed to me like black and white figures. They seemed to belong to a very distant time. And yet, Stan Laurel only died in 1965, 3 years before I was born. So in many ways, he was quite a modern figure. And the seed was probably sown then, because I wondered, well, what had he been doing, you know, in all those years? Because their heyday finishes in 1939, 1940. You know, they keep making movies with poor results. But really, the way we think of them really kind of is capped at 1940, I think.
Yeah, and so let me ask you, you sort of avoid, or you completely avoid, I believe, saying Stan Laurel in the in the book, and you constantly refer to him as he, the title character of your book. Was it hard to avoid using his name? And is there anything other than an artistic reason for doing that?
Yeah, well, there was really, because it's not true to say that Stan Laurel was born in Ulverston, Lancashire in 1890. A man named Arthur Stanley Jefferson was born in Ulverston, Lancashire in England in 1890. And Stan Laurel is an identity that he adopts when he joins the vaudeville circuit. And actually, he lives most of his life under the name Arthur Stanley Jefferson. And the book argues that you have to be very careful what you pretend to be. What he pretended to be was Stan Laurel, the figure that was seen on screen, because that's how the world will begin to perceive you. And actually, his identity was much more complex than that, and much more nebulous than that. And the truth of him lies somewhere between Arthur Jefferson, born in 1890, and a man named Stan Laurel, who by that stage had changed his name by depot, who dies in Malibu or in Santa Monica in 1965. When I made that decision, it then changed the tone of the book. It gave it a very particular rhythm, because if he was not going to be named, and if the only time that third-person male singular pronoun was going to be used would be in reference to him, it meant that every other character had to be named in full. And suddenly the book assumed the rhythm of prose poetry in a way. It gave it a very particular rhythm. And it also served a practical function, because there are a lot of names in the book. And if you keep having them knocked into your head by repetition, you don't struggle with remembering who they are, I think. So in a whole lot of ways, it helped the book. But there was a very particular reason related to the reality of his being that meant he couldn't really be named in the book.
I do love the way you say, and Jimmy Findlayson did this, and Jimmy Findlayson did that, or whoever it is that you're talking about. That's really great. So, as a writer, was it easier or harder to write a novel in which the plot was already in place and you didn't have to make it up?
You know, in one way it's harder, because real lives don't have plots. You know, they don't satisfy the demands of drama or the demands of fiction. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but it's not always satisfying. And life tends to be lived in retrospect in a strange way. It's only when we're at the end of our lives, if we're lucky enough to have the space to consider, that we begin trying to find patterns. And so the difficulty was in trying to find a pattern that satisfied fiction in a real life. And the other one is that you have an obligation to somebody who lived you can't make stuff up. It is described as a novel, but everything that happened in the book happened. A lot of the conversations happened. The difficulty with dealing with Stan is that, you know, he left a lot of letters behind him. The correspondence archive has 1,500 or 1,600 pieces of correspondence from him. He did interviews, but he didn't discuss the really curious parts of his life. He did not want to discuss why he was married 5 times, you know, why he had 2 mistresses, why when his son dies, it's not to his wife he turns, but to a woman named Alice Ardell, a French actress with whom he was having an affair. And he doesn't really talk very much about Oliver Hardy. You know, it's quite clear he has huge affection and respect for him, but the people who were interviewing him were not going to ask this elderly man difficult questions about his life and his relationships. And fiction is very good at that. Fiction is very good at exploring those emotional spaces. You can't really do it in biography, in standard biography, because standard biography can't speculate. It can't really try to fill in those gaps. It has to work with what's been given.
So when you talk about his, you know, his feelings about Oliver Hardy, or Babe, as he's known, or when you talk about his feelings about Charlie Chaplin in particular, what did you base those emotional responses on?
Well, with Babe, in part, it's the way he lived his life. You know, comedy duos frequently break up for one of 2 reasons, ego or money. Yeah, in Abbott and Costello's case, it's ego, it's money. In Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis's case, it's ego. You know, Jerry Lewis's ego really just begins to rankle with Dean Martin, and they have a falling out. Laurel and Hardy retained an affection for each other throughout their lives. They didn't really argue. They never had a falling out over money or over ego. And towards the end of his life, you know, Oliver Hardy predeceased Stan Laurel by 8 years. And really nothing becomes Dan Laurel as much as the way he behaves towards Oliver Hardy as Oliver Hardy is dying. He shows enormous tenderness towards him, enormous love. And we don't really tend to explore love in male friendships that much. Either it's in the context of a gay relationship, or it's the context of quite extreme situations like battle or, you know, people climbing mountains. And yet in everything they did through their lives, they exhibited only care for each other. Only loyalty, only affection, only respect. So there's a lot of that there. Chaplin's a more difficult case. Dan Laurel, by and large, was very reluctant to say anything bad about anyone. He was quite a reticent man in some ways. But a letter came up for auction earlier this year in which I felt kind of vindicated, because he makes clear his ambivalence towards Chaplin. He makes clear the fact that he's uneasy about Chaplin's relationships with underage girls. He's clearly upset with Chaplin's coldness towards him, with the fact that the respect that Stan Laurel had for Chaplin wasn't reciprocated. These men had a very complex relationship. It's almost like the mirror image of the relationship he has with Oliver Hardy. You know, he's younger than Chaplin. They roomed together initially. He was Chaplin's understudy. And Chaplin remained in touch with him all through his life. You know, Chaplin would call Stan Laurel when Chaplin was feeling homesick or felt he was misunderstood. And he would sneak in at the back of preview screenings to see what Stan Laurel was doing. He kept a very close eye on him. And at the end of his life, at the end of Stan Laurel's life, when Chaplin publishes his autobiography, I think Chaplin sets out to hurt Stan Laurel. I think there's no other excuse for what he does to him in that autobiography. And I think what Chaplin had realized at that stage, by that stage Chaplin was in exile in Switzerland. He was enormously respected and admired, but there was very little affection for him. And yet Stan Laurel, you know, had this pilgrimage, constant stream of modern comedians coming to visit him, to pay homage to him, to be with him, because they loved him. And Chaplin was not loved.
Well, of course, I read Chaplin's autobiography, but I read it some time ago. What does he do to stay?
Well, that's one of the things. I don't want to give away the end of the book. One of the things that, I mean, Chaplin's memoir is largely fiction. You know, it's a very peculiar thing. It is an attempt to actually reinvent himself. You know, Chaplin does not mention the fact that he was very nearly, you know, serving hard labor for getting an underage girl pregnant. You know, he does not mention the abuse of wives during marriages. he certainly is very circumspect about his early years. You know, this is a man who, you know, took his mother by the hand and put her in Cainhill Lunatic Asylum. She had syphilis. She had probably worked as a prostitute in South Africa. He ended up in unimaginable poverty on the streets. He's looked after by his brother, but yet his brother gets very little credit in the book. It is really an attempt by Chaplin to rewrite his life or the circumstances of his life before anyone else can do it. So it's a very dubious piece. It's a very interesting piece as an element of rewriting history. It's almost Stalinist in that sense, you know. But whether it's true or not, that's very different. You know, Chaplin's life was much darker than that autobiography would lead one to believe.
Well, I guess that's not entirely surprising because, you know, many people, when writing their autobiography, want to look their best. But when you think...
Oh, you do. But you know, Chaplin is quite an extreme case. You know, it was widely known in Hollywood that he had a predilection for underage girls. You know, that was part of Chaplin's very dark past. And, you know, he gets into real trouble when he meets a girl named Lisa Gray. You know, he meets Lisa Gray when she's 8 years old. He stays in touch with her until she's 12. Casts her in a film, and then is probably sleeping with her by 14 because she's pregnant at 15, you know, and suddenly he's facing real trouble, not just the implosion of his career, but the you know, potentially serious time in jail. And he tries to get her to get rid of the baby, but she won't. She's a Catholic. He decides the only way he can stay out of trouble is to take her to Mexico and marry her. And then he brings her back on the train, and he turns to her on the train and says, "You should kill yourself now because it will be easier than being married to me." And he wasn't lying. You know, none of that is in the book. So, you know, I accept absolutely, you're absolutely right that when somebody writes a memoir or a piece of autobiography, that they are obviously going to leave out some things that don't make them look good. Chaplin's is a whitewash, essentially. It bears very little relation to reality.
I think I remember Chaplin saying something like, "At this point, I was married briefly."
Yeah. You know, and then you kind of go, "Wait, you're married to a 15-year-old girl, or did you forget that?" You know, Dan Laurel had his weaknesses. His weakness was women. He married rather too often and sometimes unwisely. But there was a huge gap between that and what Chaplin was doing. And what's lovely about Stan Laurel, I think, is that he married a woman named Ruth twice, you know, the ultimate triumph of optimism over experience. And when she's going through the divorce for the second time, I mean, she's been through all of this with him before, and she's back in court, and she has to give evidence about his character at the trial. And she says something quite wonderful. What she said about him is that he wants what he doesn't have, and when he has it, he doesn't want it, which is essentially every man who ever lived. But he's still a swell fellow. You know, even she, who had been through so much with him, couldn't really bring herself to say anything terrible about him.
This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. We're talking with John Connolly, and he's a novelist, and his new novel is called He, and it's based on the life of Stan Laurel. And you were talking earlier about the affection that Laurel and Hardy have for each other. There's a book by Janine Basinger. She's a film historian. And it's called I Do and I Don't, and it's all about marriage in the movies. And she uses Laurel and Hardy as the example of the perfect marriage.
It's very, you know, their relationship with each other lasted longer than I think if you added up. Certainly Stan Laurel's marriages, three of them, you know, they were... Oliver Hardy was married three times. Stan Laurel was married five. Their relationship endured. And what's often quite interesting about the films is that you can often see aspects of their domestic relationships reflected in the films themselves.
They often, you know, share a bed.
Yeah, they do. You know, they're quite aware of the fact that there's a lovely film which I've been showing when I've been doing events called Their First Mistake, which is a really...
The baby, when they adopt the baby.
The baby, but that's a really curious film. It's such a knowing film. It's aware of the, you know, even in that day and age, they were having gay slurs thrown at them, and they're quite aware of it in the context of that film. There's a lovely exchange where Stan Laurel asks Oliver Hardy, you know, what the problem is with his wife, and Oliver Hardy says, "Well, she thinks I care more for you than I do for her," and Stan Laurel says, well, you do, don't you?" And Oliver Hardy says, "We won't even go into that." You know, they know, they're aware of all of these things. They do. There's a, you know, what I found really curious is that the extent to which their lives became intertwined, their personal lives became intertwined, and quite often if one of them is getting divorced, there's a point, I think, shortly after making Way Out West, or when they're making it, where they're both going through really unpleasant divorce cases. And women from previous relationships also crop up at exactly the same time. And their lives begin to mirror each other in a very strange way. And the film they're making, I think, becomes a kind of escape for them. It is the only solidity they have. And it took Stan Laurel, I think, a long time to accept that. Stan Laurel was the great nearly man of Hollywood. You know, he was supposed to be a star. And he was supposed to be a star like Keaton and Harold Lloyd and Chaplin by himself. And it never happened because he never had a character. You know, Chaplin had the little tramp. Harold Lloyd had Harold with the boulder and glasses. Buster Keaton was old stone face. Stan Laurel was a very accomplished actor, but he never had a single character that he could actually lay claim to. And it's only when he's paired with Oliver Hardy that he begins to realize that he's going to be part of a twin star. And yet he rails against it for a long time. You know, he struggles to accept that. And what I find quite lovely is a slow realization of how much he has come to depend on Oliver Hardy, both professionally and personally. You know, his relationship with Babe becomes the rock in his life. It is the only stability he has. He keeps shedding marriages, but Babe is always there, and Babe never leaves him.
How do you account for the fact that you two men, are able to live and work as closely as you've had to together and be able to stay together for that many years?
Well, we went living closely together, or association, for many years when we were making pictures. Our closest association was the last few years that we worked abroad, because we traveled together, we lived in the same hotel, we were at the theater together. So it was the closest that we've ever been in actual contact. At the studio, we'd get through with a picture and I probably wouldn't see him again until we made the next picture. See, he liked to golf, I liked to go fishing. My interest was in the pictures. He had no interest whatsoever in the writing of the pictures or the production of the pictures. He said himself that he prefers to keep out of it. That just having to do it is enough, to all that he wanted.
Well, did he enjoy working in the film?
Oh, he enjoyed it. Glad to see him when he came back. And, you know, it was a reunion sort of thing. And we just saw each other as we made a picture, but after that, we didn't till we finally went on the road.
Well, since you worked so long with Mr. Hardy, do you feel that you could have worked or could have achieved what you have, or indeed could he have achieved what he did, with a partner other than you?
That's hard to tell.
Mm-hmm. You feel that you would have teamed up? Of course, most of your theatrical life has been in terms of teamwork.
That's right.
You've done very little solo work.
No, I was never successful in solo work. Always had to have a foil.
Yeah, one of the things I found most fascinating in your novel, He, you know, is that Oliver Hardy, as you're saying, is what Stan Laurel needed to rise to that higher level as a comedian. But the teaming of Laurel and Hardy was really a limit to Oliver Hardy artistically, if not financially.
I think that's probably true. He certainly had more opportunities to move outside the partnership. He was a more accomplished actor. He had started out as a projectionist, so he understood something that Stan Laurel's generation of comedians, who had come out of vaudeville on the stage, took longer to realize, which is that if you're acting for the screen, you're not acting for the back row. You know, these were all theater actors, and theaters would have been noisy, boisterous places. So you're always trying to project yourself, and you always had to act large. But Oliver Hardy understood that if you're acting for the screen, you're acting for the front row. And he's very subtle. You know, he doesn't come from a stage background. He's a singer. His knowledge of film comes from A, being a projectionist, and B, then trying to find a place in filmmaking before it even moves to Hollywood. So there's a subtlety to him that Stan Laurel takes a while to acquire. And so he always had offers. John Wayne and John Ford wanted him to join their traveling group of players. And he only makes one film with them, The Fighting Kentuckian, and he does appear to have wandered in from a completely different movie, but a much better movie than the one we're watching. And you kind of figure, I'd much rather be watching the film that he came out of.
In The Fighting Kentuckian also, it's interesting that Oliver Hardy's character is nothing like Ollie.
Oh, no, he's not. No, and I think that was part of the pleasure that he took in doing it. And I think he had a real subtlety. He had a career as a character actor. Had he wanted it, it would have been available to him. And he needed the money. He had made terrible mistakes with his tax. And not only did he have alimony to pay, but he had forgotten to file the right papers with the IRS after a divorce, and they hounded him for money until his death. So he was always in trouble for money. But he wouldn't take those jobs. And he wouldn't take those jobs because he knew Stan Laurel wouldn't have similar offers. And if he were to take those jobs, it would detract from, I guess, the magic or the chemistry of what they had. He realized, I think, that if they were going to have an enduring legacy, it would be the two of them together. And even then, when he takes the job in the Fighting Kentuckian, he divides the money equally with Stan Laurel, even though Stan Laurel has no place in the film. You know, that was the way that they behaved towards each other. They were not typical of the time.
Oliver Hardy actually consults with Stan Laurel first before making the Fighting Kentucky, and he sort of asks permission, sort of.
Oh, he did, and that's what he did. He went to him and said, "Do you mind if I do this?" He was very solicitous towards him, and he also, I think, there is a slight imbalance in the partnership because Stan Laurel wasn't just acting in these films; he was co-writing them, he was co-directing them. He would spend a week in the edit suite, sleeping and eating there to try and get the rhythms right. These were his constructions, in a way, and he couldn't do them without Oliver Hardy, but equally, what the material he gives Oliver Hardy is so much better than anything he had ever had before. You know, they have this perfect symbiotic relationship, and they're both very reluctant to do anything that might disturb it.
Well, John Connolly, tell us, weigh in on the silence versus sound, Laurel and Hardy. In your book, you imply that Stan was more of a fan of the silence than the sound pictures.
I think he's a miniaturist. There are writers who are better short story writers than novelists. I'm thinking of somebody like Donald Barthelme, for example, or Raymond Carver, who never really moves into the long form. That's what they do. Stan was always happier about 17 to 20 minutes because he didn't like plotting. And the more time you have, the more plot you require. And maybe perhaps equally, the more, if you have sound, you have to have dialogue. But he moved very comfortably into sound filming, I think. I prefer the sound films because I think if you look at something like Their First Mistake, part of the pleasure on it is the verbal interplay. We sometimes think of them as very slapstick comedians, but actually some of the scripts are very, very witty, and rely on the kind of verbal sparks that wouldn't have been out of place in the screwball comedies of someone like Preston Sturges. But because they're put in short films, maybe we tend to underestimate them a little bit. They were much happier to make the transfer into sound than Chaplin was. Even when Chaplin's speech can be recorded, he chooses not to make those films. He's very wary of it because he knows he's the greatest pantomimist that probably the world has ever seen. But he's probably, if he starts speaking, he's just going to be another actor. And he's very reluctant to do that, whereas they are not. They slot very comfortably into the sound era, in part because they're fortunate that their voices match their personas a little bit. They kind of sound like you'd expect them to sound.
Well, it's interesting that the 12 years in between the coming of sound and Chaplin's first sound feature, when he makes, two pictures, and Stan Laurel makes 30 pictures.
Yeah, but I guess the problem is that, for Chaplin's a genius. There's no detracting from that at all. And if we were to pick the 10 greatest comedies ever made, you could argue that two or three of them would probably be Chaplin's films. You can kind of see the genius of them writ large. He's putting his own money into these films. He's directing them. He's writing them. When the gold rush isn't working out, when he's not happy with the rushes from it, he goes back and starts again. He is a meticulous artist. But because Dan Laurel is committed to the short form and prefers it, it's probably slightly harder. We maybe take them more for granted because there was a perception of the time that they were filler. They weren't first feature stuff. And it's really only when John McCabe, the Californian academic, begins looking at these films again in the late 50s, early 60s, that he points out that actually this is genius of a different type. To go back to that analogy, it's like the person who's the brilliant short story writer. They are perfect in their form. The best of them are worthy to stand alongside anything, I think, that was made in that time period.
Also, when you talk about the shorts and their lack of plotting, they sometimes end you know, just kind of abruptly. And they have a sort of a surreal quality because they're just over. Like, for instance, in their first mistake when they adopt a baby, you know, whatever happens to the baby, you know, it's just over now.
It ends. And yet it ends. On another way, I've watched the film so often now because it's one of those films I show. In another way, it can't end any other way because it's a film about regression, I think. It's a film about regression from adulthood to childhood to infancy. And effectively, it ends with the perfect moment of infancy. So it couldn't really end any other way. And yet, you're right, on first viewing, it seems quite abrupt. But I think also we have to view it that it's almost like we're watching parts of a continuum. You know, these are the same characters who crop up film after film after film. We get that sense that they have been together for a long time, that, you know, last week they were trying to get a piano up a flight of stairs, you know, this week they're living in rooms trying to hide a dog, you know, that they're almost like these people who've been cast adrift in the aftermath of the Depression. And every so often we're privy to a little part of their lives, and maybe ultimately we look at the whole of it, and all of these things will knit together. So I tend to be quite forgiving of the fact that the films don't have perfect beginning, middles, and ends, because I view them as episodes in an ongoing pair of lives, I suppose.
In which sometimes they're married and sometimes they're not.
Yeah, exactly. So, and sometimes the characters change suddenly. In something like The Music Box, which is probably the most famous film where they're trying to carry that piano up the flight of stairs, Stan's the slightly more aggressive party in it. You know, he's the one who loses his temper. You know, he's the one who shouts at Oliver Hardy. They didn't always play quite those roles where Stan was subservient to Oliver. They were prepared to deviate slightly as it suited them, and that was part of the fascination of it, to see them experimenting, because they were experimenting. You know, every artistic life involves compromise. And the compromise Stan Laurel made was that he wouldn't get paid particularly well by Hal Roach. Hal Roach didn't cheat them, but he certainly didn't pay them any more than he had to. On the other hand, he gave Stan Laurel huge amounts of artistic freedom. Within the budget, he could do almost anything that he wanted. And their problems really arise when they moved to Fox and MGM in the 40s, where suddenly they don't have artistic freedom. They've been given more money, but actually they have no input into the films they're making. And I think Stan comes to realize that he's made a devil's bargain, that, you know, he's got more money in his pocket, but the films he's going to make as a consequence are going to be much, much worse.
It's interesting, a very similar thing happens to Buster Keaton, right? Because when Keaton moves to MGM and they team him with Jimmy Durante, I mean, his movies are terrible, but they made a whole lot more money than any of the artistically great Buster Keaton movies.
Yeah, exactly. And these were, you know, somebody like Hal Roach, he was always moving in and out of financial problems. He was never really, you know, he would have ambitions. He tried to make The Wizard of Oz. He wanted to film opera and operetta. He got into a partnership with Mussolini's son, which was a disaster. You know, he had great ambitions, but he didn't have that kind of structure that was required to produce, you know, large-scale features, I don't think. That wasn't really quite in his blood. You know, Keaton's problem is that Stan Laurel isn't an alcoholic. Stan Laurel doesn't handle drink very well, but, you know, he doesn't have an alcohol problem. You know, if he's depressed, he drinks more than he should and then ends up marrying the wrong person, which happens at some point. You know, Keaton's problem, Keaton is a serious alcoholic, and his judgment is grotesquely impaired by it. You know, Keaton is the man who gets married to a woman when they're both completely intoxicated, and she wakes up the next morning and doesn't know who he is. You know, we've all done things wrong with a couple of drinks on us, but waking up with a wedding ring on your finger, turning over on the pillow and going, "Who are you?" is quite extreme. So, you know, Keaton in a sense is his own worst enemy. And what's lovely is actually that Stan Laurel is very solicitous towards Keaton. Stan Laurel was very generous towards other actors. You know, Keaton would come around to his house, would get a meal, they would play cards together. So too would Lou Costello. And when Stan Laurel died, Keaton was heartbroken. I mean, there's a very incredible scene of Keaton weeping at Stan Laurel's funeral. And he said, and what Keaton said was, he was the best of us. He was better than Chaplin. And I think part of that was that Stan Laurel showed enormous kindness towards him at a time when he was a bit, he'd been cast aside by Hollywood. You know, he was trying to make a bit of money doing candid camera. or appearing in it's a funny thing. I'm trying to figure out what year a funny thing happened on the Waiting Forum is. You know, he turns up in that briefly as well.
Or even worse, how to stuff a wild bikini or something like that.
Yeah, his star has faded, and yet Stan Laurel was there. Stan Laurel was always there for people.
Well, so in this book, and I just think it's a great book, and congratulations on it.
Thank you. You're so kind.
You must have done a lot of research, and it must have taken you a long while, and at the same time, you've written so many other novels. What made you decide that this was the time to write He?
It wasn't that. It actually just took me so long to write it, and it took me so long to get to the point where I thought I could do him justice. You're right. It took a huge amount of time to research. It was 10 years before I actually acknowledged to myself that I might be considering writing a novel. I kept accumulating research materials. And then I was pretty much committed to it for certain last 10 years. The writing of it didn't take quite so long. It was getting to the point where I had figured out something approaching a structure. And I thought that I had enough skills that I might be able to do his life justice. I simply couldn't have written it 10 years ago. I don't think I would have been a good enough writer. I'm not saying that I'm a great writer now, but I'm a better writer than I was, and I felt I could maybe do him some justice.
And what will happen in the next chapter of John Connolly? Will you go back and write more thrillers, or do you have something else in mind?
Oh, well, I have the next Charlie Parker thriller is out in June, and I'm working on a book, another Parker book for next year. In the interim, I finished a book on film. I've become quite fascinated by the processes through which films come into being. And I've written a book about the making of a kind of obscure Spanish horror film that was released in the 1970s. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it. I have an agreement with a small publisher to publish it. It really is a little labor of love. So kind of that's where I am. You know, writing ideas aren't the currency. It's time that's the currency. It's a bit like for readers, money isn't the currency. It's the time to read books. So there'll always be more ideas out there than I'll have time to do. But I have a fascination with film, and writing this Stan Laurel book really has only added fuel to that fire, I think.
And you did a magnificent job. The book is called He, a novel, and the author, my guest, John Connolly, thank you so much for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
It was so kind of you to have me on the show. I'm really very grateful.
John Connolly, author of He, a novel based on the life of Stan Laurel. John Connolly's latest Charlie Parker thriller, A Woman in the Woods, is available now. And after a break, we'll talk about Lenny Bruce with the late comedian's daughter, Kitty Bruce. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Stick around. You're listening to KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Our next topic is the comedian Lenny Bruce. It's been 50 years since the death of comedian Lenny Bruce, and he was more than a stand-up comedian. He was an iconoclast who blazed the trail for Richard Pryor and George Carlin and generations of comic minds to follow. He was persecuted for challenging the powers that be. He left behind a wealth of recordings and an amazing book, originally serialized in Playboy magazine, and now reprinted for a new generation. The book is How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, and its republication is the occasion for a visit from my guest, Kitty Bruce, Lenny Bruce's daughter. Kitty Bruce, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you were just telling me that you just came back from Brandeis. Tell us what that's all about.
Okay. I was trying to get my father's autobiography republished for at least, I would say, 7 years. And apparently there just wasn't any interest because it had been out for so very long. And only a couple were in print, I think, and they were Simon and Schuster. So finally, we get a book deal, and I was very happy because I wanted to introduce my father to a new generation. I didn't want his work to be forgotten. I didn't, for somebody who doesn't know Lenny Bruce or never heard him, it's still, without all that, it's really a good read.
It really is a fabulous book.
It really it is. I mean, okay, so I went up to Brandeis, and there was a two-day symposium. Lewis Black did some entertaining, and he's funny. Oh, my God, is he funny. And there was symposiums, one right after the other, on everything from humor to comedy in the Constitution. It was amazing that all these people, we had people come from Japan, from Paris, and just to learn and discuss about Lenny Bruce. And it really, Gary, it humbled me. I was floored. I looked around and I looked at all these people that paid to come to this conference to look at the exhibit.
What kinds of things would they see there?
Well, I had everything up in my attic, and which is not a good place for it.
Uh-huh.
And quick story, a man from Paris called me, and he said, my name is Steve Krayoff, and I've done my PhD on Lenny Bruce, and I would like to present it to you. And now I'm thinking to myself, who does their PhD on Lenny Bruce? So he comes from Paris, he gets on a plane, and lands in New York, then he takes a 3.5-hour bus ride to the town in which I live. And he walks in, and he had not one, but two big, they look like two yellow pages, one on top of the other.
Hmm.
And it was his PhD on Lenny Bruce, and he brought two of them. And he said that in case, you know, I wanted a copy. And it was all in French. And they were so massive, I wanted to see how much they weighed. So I put them on a scale, and they weighed 5 pounds apiece. So this young man had really delved into my father's work, his thoughts, everything. So he comes to my house, and I'm showing him pictures and letters and different things of my father's, and he said, you know, you should really look into having this preserved. And I said, I don't know. He said, call up Hugh Hefner. And I said, I'm not going to call Hugh Hefner and ask him to do, you know, just don't. And he says, well, I think they should go to Brandeis. And I said, why Brandeis? And he said, because it's the type of university that they didn't, it was one of the reasons it was so important was that Jews, after the war, were not being accepted into Ivy League schools. And they had such high test scores that they were being discriminated against because of their religious and or their affiliation. So Albert Einstein and a couple other great minds got together and made this university happen. And Justice Brandeis, he was very, very old when he passed, but he was a very smart and scholarly man. So everything is there. It's 10 linear feet.
Wow.
You
had that in your attic?
Yeah.
You have a big attic.
Yeah. Well, my attic, it's just ridiculous. I call myself the keeper of the dead people things because I have my mother in one corner, my grandmother in another corner, my grandfather's second wife, my dad, my late husband. So there's a lot of stuff up there.
Yeah.
And so I'm just thrilled that.
Well, so tell me, what would I see if I was looking there at Brandeis? What's in this 10 linear feet?
Okay, well, from the exhibit, if I shut my eyes, you'd walk in and you'd see pictures, a lot of photographs that are on the wall. There's different personal letters that are encased in glass. There is, God, I don't even know how many hundreds of hours of tapes that the Grammy Foundation gave Brandeis a grant, and they were able to take all the reel-to-reels and put them on digital so you could listen. There's court transcripts. I mean, it's massive, Gary.
Well,
massive.
That's so great.
Oh, yeah. I'm so thrilled that I just am so thrilled. I'm in awe, in absolute awe.
So now you've got this wonderful archive there. The book has been republished. A couple of years ago, I know you did this other wonderful thing, the Let the Buyer Beware, that you co-produced. It was a six-disc thing. So is there still a lot left that hasn't come out?
That collection came from, my idea was that I wanted people to know what made Lenny Bruce tick. And I still haven't figured it out. And the premise of the CDs was to start from the very beginning of his life and his career and take it all the way until the day he died, which was on tape. He loved to tape, constantly taping things. And I forgot what I was going to say.
We're just talking about this box set. So did he actually tape himself on the day that he died, you're saying?
There was tapes of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just massive. Is there more? Absolutely. Is it being housed? Absolutely. Okay. The collection is open for researchers. There were scholars, law students, professors, It's there to and can be used for so many different things. So many. The English language, the use of the English language, the gross misuse of power in the government.
Yeah.
Especially, I was reading a chapter out of How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, and, you know, you have to remember that he was being arrested, pulled off stage and arrested for talking. And the excuse was obscenity. And he talks about this in the book very clearly. And so the excuse was obscenity, but the real reason was the content. He shook up people's core belief systems. And when you start playing around with beliefs, what somebody holds dear to their heart, mom, apple pie, religion, and the flag. You start playing with that, and there's going to be an issue. He was talking about what people were thinking.
That's right. I'm so glad that you got the book back in print, and it's called How to Talk Dirty.
And the proceeds for the part that I would get go directly to the Lenny Bruce Memorial Foundation. And we're a non-for-profit charity, and what we do is we provide life-saving scholarships for men and women, young people, anybody who has an issue with drug and alcohol and needs treatment.
Well,
that's
great.
And so we scholarship them by paying for their treatment, their sober living, whatever and wherever that they need help in. And it helps change lives, and it honors my father's memory in something that's doing something, you know? But if you want to find out about it, you can go to LennyBruce.org.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it's a marvelous book, and I think, so there's a double reason for buying it, because it's great. How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, an autobiography by Lenny Bruce, and we've been chatting with my guest, his daughter, Kitty Bruce. Kitty, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Aw, thank you so much, Gary. And thanks, everybody, for listening. It was nice meeting you all.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guests, Kitty Bruce. She's the daughter of Lenny Bruce, whose autobiography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People, is now, thanks to Kitty Bruce, back in print. And John Connolly. His novel, He, based on the life of Stan Laurel, is great, and his latest Charlie Parker thriller, A Woman in the Woods, is available now. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.